Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMC ortho.
Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us today in the studio for Medical Monday, we've got a real wonderful guest, Dr. Deborah Buccino. She is board-certified pediatrician with McEnany Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine in Great Barrington. She specializes in the emotional development of children and adolescents, post-concussion care, adolescent gynecology, international travel medicine, and healthcare technology. Dr. Buccino earned her medical degree from Harvard Medical School. She completed her residency in pediatrics at Boston Children's Hospital. She's a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics and also serves as school physician at Berkshire School and Bard College at Simon's Rock. Dr. Buccino, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thanks a lot, Alan. It's nice to be here.
It's really great. It's really great to see you here. What a pedigree you have in terms of your background and your education. What brought you to the Berkshires?
Well, I did summer some in the Berkshires with my family, and it's a nice place to live. It's a nice mix of people, and I enjoy doing big city medicine in the small town.
Well, we're very glad that you are in our small town. McEnany, which is combination what of Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New York?
Right. We took artistic license and just came up with that name since we get patients from all three of those states.
Yeah. And it is a major practice, and you've been in business for a long time. So we're going to get telephone calls this morning on major things. But what's really hot in pediatrics right now?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, concussions people are thinking about a lot now because there's been a lot of advances in the knowledge we have and how we're treating patients around concussions. In fact, Berkshire Health Systems is opening a concussion rehabilitation clinic in the next coming weeks, which should be exciting.
Where will that be?
At Berkshire Medical Center in the rehab department.
Right, right. And just between us, forget about anybody else. If a mother comes to you and says, should I allow my child to play football, what would you say?
It depends on the parent. I mean, I think that and how they feel about things. I think that there are certainly potential dangers, but there's dangers in everything we do in life. And I think that if a child wants to play and they're educated about how they go about it and the coaches are knowledgeable about how to take care of concussions when they happen, then it can be a safe and enjoyable and productive thing to do.
And very quickly, exactly what is a concussion again?
A concussion is an injury to the brain when either the head is hit, the neck is hit, the rest of the body's hit, and then the brain hits against the skull and it causes swelling and inflammation that end up causing biochemical changes that can cause symptoms anywhere from the common headaches, upset stomach, problems with concentration at school, and emotional difficulties.
And you can die from it, right?
That's the second impact syndrome in particular. If the concussion is bad enough in the first place and there's bleeding and it's missed, then people can die from it then. But part of the reason people are becoming so careful is that if someone's hit in the head again, even a very minor hit, after within 2 weeks of that first injury, then there can be sudden swelling in the brain, which can result in death.
And what do they call that swelling?
Second impact syndrome is the fatal death.
Okay. Now, the other thing is there was a while that everybody was getting concentration drugs, for want of a better word, among our young people. Was that overdone, number one? And number two, bring us up to date where we are on that.
I think you're referring to the ADHD or attention deficit disorder. Yes, so that's a hot topic. A lot of people are thinking and talking about it. I think that one point I would like to make is that there are definitely situations where these medicines make a huge difference in children's experience of life and school. So there are certain times that it's very, very beneficial and important to use. There are times when it's misused as well for maybe more marginal kinds of attention type things. For instance, college students that want to just study better for one night or something like that. So there can be misuse of the medicines, but it's a very important area to pay attention to.
Do you get leaned on as a physician to prescribe?
Sometimes one can, but I think that as you're a practicing pediatrician, I mean, I think one of the really nice things about primary care pediatrics, that in addition to all those kind of special interest areas you mentioned, I have most of my practice is doing general primary care. And it's a big part of that is developing a relationship with a family over time. And when you're prescribing in the context of that, I don't think you end up getting pressured a lot. I mean, people can have strong feelings, but then there's a lot of back and forth education. If you educate people how the medicines work, why we're using the medicine, then if it's not appropriate, the family will generally understand and they'll recognize that the whole job we have, one of the major things we have as a physician is trying to weigh risk versus benefit and helping the family with those decisions.
Okay, let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Okay, Jim, you're on.
How do you determine the dosages on the medications that may have been formulated for adults?
So, Jim, that's a really good and interesting question. Sometimes we can base medicines based on weight and a certain milligram dosage per weight. But there's a lot of impetus now in the American Academy of Pediatrics and other organizations that are trying to do more studies on medications in children in particular, because it isn't always the case that the ways they work in adults are going to be the same in children.
Well, following up on Jim's good question, when does a child who's been to see you for their entire life, when do they become graduated out of your practice, or are they allowed to stay?
Well, it depends on the practice. Our practice tends to keep people through college because pediatricians can certainly take care of children through that age range, particularly if they're more trained in adolescent medicine. And it's hard, I think, sometimes for patients to establish a new doctor when they're in the midst of college. So we like to see them through that lifespan and get them on their way to adulthood. But it's up to the child. Sometimes they feel uncomfortable at the pediatrician's office, so they'll switch somewhere sooner.
Little chairs.
We have big ones, too.
1-800-348-2551. Jim, thank you for your always good call. Appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551. So the question I would have for you is, do you find that parents can be difficult? I don't know how to say this right, but difficult to work with because so many parents have ideas about things.
It's one of the challenges of being a pediatrician, but again, it's a challenge, and I think a lot of pediatricians find that rewarding, that part of things working as a team. We really see it as a team. The parent brings in what they want out of the encounter, and then we give them medical knowledge and make the decisions together.
Yeah. I remember my doctor, the late Dr. Whitfield, our pediatrician in Great Barrington, who has legendary status for me. We were down in Florida. The kid got our son Jonas, who's now 40, got roseola, and we were with an old physician who said you've got to put him in ice water. And I called our guy and said, well, there's a doctor down here, says ice water. And he says, I'm your doctor, not that guy. We haven't done that for 20 years. Is there ever a time you have to raise your voice?
Raise my voice? I don't tend to raise my voice. But I think that brings up a good point that we really like to establish that relationship. So we often have families calling when they're away on vacation, checking in with us. And a lot of it is that relationship and giving education and reassurance. It goes a long way.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. So, Donna, you stay right where you are. We'll be right back with you. Okay, Donna? Mm-hmm.
support comes from Arts Mid-Hudson and Half Moon Theater, presenting the one-man comedy Fully Committed January 16th through 25th at the CIA's Marriott Pavilion Theater, halfmoontheater.org. And Lori Stillwell, CPA PC, providing tax and accounting services for businesses and their owners in Saratoga Springs and beyond, stillwellcpa.com.
Thank you, Zachary, for bringing us back to reality. Let's go to Donna in Saratoga Springs. Okay. Donna, you have a good question. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you for this topic and your guest. I have a 13-year-old boy, and his doctor a while ago asked us whether we wanted to give him the vaccination, and forgive my ignorance, but for the HPV virus, if I'm correct. And I'm not against giving him another vaccination. I just want to kind of know how effective it is and what some of the side effects might be.
Sure. That's a good question to be thinking about. I'm glad you brought it up for males, too, because this vaccine came out maybe 15 years ago, primarily given first to the females. It's for human papillomavirus, which is a virus that we pick up through sexual activity. But it's an important virus because it's one that stays in our body for life often once we're exposed. And the vaccine is very close to 98-99% protection against the strains of the virus that cause us the most trouble. The concern has been that the HPV virus is associated with certain kinds of cancer, cervical cancer for women, but other kinds of cancer as well, including throat cancers. And the vaccine has been widely used now for 10 years, so it provides excellent protection with an excellent safety profile. There really haven't been any serious side effects at this point associated with the vaccine, other than the sometimes painfulness associated with the injection. Occasionally, teenagers have been known to faint after the vaccine, but that's a short-lived side effect. And the current thinking actually is that teenagers tend to faint after a lot of vaccines, not just particularly the HPV vaccine. So we think it is a very good vaccine now to give to both young teenagers, male and female.
But just to get this straight, the reason to give it to a male is not only to protect females, but to protect males.
Themselves, exactly. The thing about this virus is that currently it often doesn't cause symptoms. There's no good treatment for it. People don't know they have it.
And
so they're
huge,
passing
right?
it back and forth. The studies have shown that before we started using the vaccine, about 75% of people in their 20s had been exposed to this virus. So it's very common, yes. But again, I will make the point that in addition to helping prevent the spread back and forth between males and females, it does protect the males against certain kinds of cancer.
And if the males have the HPV virus in them and they get the injection, then what?
Well, the interesting thing is that if you're exposed to HPV virus as a teenager,
right.
you often clear it from your system.
Oh.
But the vaccine is given to teenagers, hopefully, before they've been exposed to the virus even the first time. And it will then protect them through their 20s and older.
Donna, any follow-up?
I appreciate it. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Donna.
Have a great day.
1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are great, and we encourage you to call. That's why we have the program, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to David. All right, David, your turn.
Good afternoon. Doctor, I was reading an article in a local college library back around Christmas time, and it was in either New Scientist or one of the more well-known science magazines. And the article was about concern regarding putting children ages 3 years and under under anesthesia, and that there was some concern about the effects on brain development. I must admit I was kind of stunned to read this, and I took it to a librarian who was there, because I know that she has young kids and I don't have any children, and she had not heard of this. And it said in there that up to 6 million children 3 years and under are put under anesthesia for various procedures each year, and actually I think it said about half of those are 12 months and under. Now the FDA, I believe it was the FDA, was supposed to render a decision by the end of the year. Just one other point that I'd like you to comment on, if you could A, give me an update on that, And B was the article, and again, this may have been the slant of the article, but it was almost jaw-dropping, that it seemed like the FDA was having trouble raising money either from the federal government or from whatever sources to pursue this. And the librarian and I were just really shocked. So if you could comment on that, and I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
No, stay on the air because we may have a question. Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Thank you so much for bringing those topics up. That's it really brings up a couple interesting points. I can't speak directly to that study because I haven't seen it, but I think the points that it makes me think about are, one, there are a lot of children under three who need anesthesia for certain procedures. We have pediatric anesthesiologists that help weigh the risk versus benefit of doing that anesthesia, but sometimes it's necessary. I think there's a lot of information yet that there's direct harm to the brain, although the whole point of medicine is that we need to be continuously thinking about these potential harm in addition to what we think we're doing is good work. So I think it's important for us to always be looking at those things. It's a big decision to put a child under 3 years old, or any child really, or any person, under general anesthesia, because there are certain risks about it, which is why we have the anesthesiologists who specialize in the putting people to sleep and things like that. I don't quite know why the FDA would have trouble looking at this in particular, although it goes back to the question we had before about there really isn't enough science on pediatric studies of medicine. And the American Academy of Pediatrics is definitely pushing for more of that because there's been an assumption that the physiology of children is often like little adults, and that's not always the case. So we need to look at that. I would like to make one more point about information that parents find. Information is at our fingertips these days on the web. And I know I always tell my patients, I like them to be well-read. If they see something on the internet that concerns them, it's really important to bring it back to the doctor. Like if they're reading about some symptom they have that makes them very concerned, go back, have a conversation about it with the doctor, which I'm glad, that makes me glad that you called today to talk about what you read and the thoughts that it generated in you, and try to get more scientific information behind that.
If I can find the article, I'll send it to Alan, and then he could send it on to you.
We'll do. Thank you so much, David. Great
call. You're
welcome. Appreciate it. All right, let's go to Tiffany in Sturbridge. Tiffany, you there?
Hi. Yes. My daughter will be 9 this month, and I was just wondering, when is it appropriate time to start having talks about like birds and bees with her? She hasn't really asked anything, but I'm sure, you know, between school and her getting older, those kind of topics are going to come up soon. And how do you go about broaching the subject?
Yeah, Tiffany, I think those are really important things to think about. And again, I'm glad you brought that up, because those are the things that pediatricians can be helpful with when you go to see your pediatrician. It's not just about giving shots and taking care of ear infections. We really want to help with the development of the child. I think it can be different for each child and family. But I like to, around this age, get some basics out there. Sometimes I think it's a nice thing to do to get a book about these kinds of topics. There's one author, Robi Harris, R-O-B-I-E. Her last name is H-A-R-R-I-S. She's written a lot of different books around this topic. One is called Perfectly Normal. So it's a very non-biased approach to getting the basics out there. And I think if you have a book to read through with your child, or even just have around the house, then when they're curious, they can look at the book, and it can be a conversation generator as well. But I think it is important for children to understand what's happening to the bodies around them, because even if their bodies aren't changing yet, then their friends may be.
I never had that conversation with my parents. So the question I have for you is, and I think Tiffany really raised it, somehow the information does get out, as bad as it may be when it gets out. How important is this?
Well, I think our generation now, as we're raising children now, we are much more open and willing to talk about these things, which I think in general is very healthy, because before, when people didn't have straightforward conversations, there was a lot of misinformation out there, and I think people probably took more risks than they needed to in general.
Good. Tiffany, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Yep. 1-800-348-2551. Here's a real fast one, doctor, that came in at WAMC.org. Good afternoon, doctor. Considering how dangerous it can be for adults to get shingles, would you say that it is better to let children get chickenpox so that they can develop an immunity for later in life?
So that question brings up interesting point, the difference between chickenpox and shingles.
Right.
So just to be clear, chickenpox is a disease that was used to be a common childhood disease. Now with the vaccine, less people are getting it. But anyone who ever gets chickenpox is susceptible to getting shingles, which because the virus lives dormant in the nerve root, and then later on when the body's stressed, the chickenpox goes to the surface and creates shingles. So you have to have had chickenpox to develop the shingles. So then the question becomes, is it better to get the natural chickenpox versus be vaccinated? In actuality, getting the vaccine gives you more protection against getting shingles in the future, because if you don't get the full-blown viremia in your body, you're going to have less in the nerve root to come to the surface later on. So that's a reason to give the chickenpox vaccine, because it makes it less likely to get shingles in the future.
That's pretty clear. Let's go to Kelly in Albany. All right, Kelly, you're on.
Hello?
Hi, Kelly, you're on.
Hi. I have a question about diagnosing and figuring out gluten insensitivity or gluten allergy or intolerance in a child. I'm currently working with my pediatrician, and I'm going to be working with a specialist as well. And I am just having a hard time finding good information online about accuracy of tests and, you know, how easy it is to actually diagnose in a small child.
Kelly, you bring up some great points, and I think one thing we should be clear about is there's true gluten allergy, which we call celiac disease, and then there's gluten sensitivity. How old is your child?
Almost one.
One. So it's more likely that there's a gluten sensitivity, but I'll step back a second. Celiac disease, which is true gluten allergy, has pretty good tests associated with it. There's a screening blood test that tests for an antibody, because it's an autoimmune disease. It tests for an antibody that then attacks the intestines. If that test is negative, then it's very unlikely the child has true gluten allergy. If the test is positive, it's just a screen. The diagnosis needs to be confirmed by an actual endoscopy and biopsy of the intestines, so colonoscopy and or endoscopy. But then people are realizing that there's probably a lot of people out there with a gluten sensitivity. Unfortunately, there's no good diagnostic test for this. The best we can do is what we call a two-week elimination diet, where you're really good about keeping all the gluten products out of the body and tracking the symptoms, whether it's abdominal pain, gas, not feeling like eating, and then you actually reintroduce the gluten products 2 weeks after and track the symptoms after that. But again, especially in a one-year-old, I think it should be done in the context of talking with your pediatrician, because the symptoms can be pretty subtle at that age. And it's hard to know. You have to be careful about balancing, making sure you're getting the right nutrition. Is it worth taking the gluten out? Are the symptoms bad enough? But those are the things we think about.
Kelly, if I may ask, what are the symptoms in your child's case?
She gets gas and has very uncomfortable, foul-smelling diarrhea, and it seems we are doing an elimination diet, and the few times when we have been accidentally exposed to gluten on it, it seems like that's the culprit. Her tests have come back negative, and part of the problem I'm running into in figuring this out is that I've also read that if somebody does have celiac disease and they never have gluten, that they're not going to show those symptoms. So until the damage has been done, you won't actually have celiac disease as we currently diagnose it. So I'm kind of in this conundrum of, you know, diagnosing or continuing a restrictive diet, and it's hard to figure out.
It can be hard to figure out, and it can be frustrating to have those symptoms. I think that, the damage is cumulative, and it's true, the younger the child is, then you may not have developed those antibodies, which is why it's worth continually thinking about celiac disease. But I think it's, again, medicine, we want to have clear-cut answers, but there often aren't any. So we're working with our doctors to weigh the risk versus the benefit of whatever intervention we're choosing, which in this case is the limiting the diet.
Kelly, thanks for the great call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm sure a lot of people will profit by it. Okay, we'll go to Joe in Rotterdam. Okay, Joe, you're on.
Hi, I got a question about tonsils. It seems like the children today are not having them removed as frequently as the children of the 60s when I had them removed. Is that true?
I think you're right in that perception, Joe. This is one of the things that's kind of waxed and waned. I would say two generations ago in the 60s, there were more tonsillectomies being done. The tonsils were being taken out. And then we went through a period where people weren't taking the tonsils out as much. Again, this gets back to the weighing the risk versus benefit of whatever intervention we do. The tonsils are part of the immune system, so one has to really think about how much difficulty they're causing. So I think what happened was the bar for deciding they were causing enough difficulty to take them out was raised. So that people really had to have a lot of difficulties. And now the current recommendations are something like 6 to 7 strep throats in a year before they'll think about taking the tonsils out. However, people are moving back to, again, involving the family. If the child is having a sore throat that keeps him out of school for 3 days every month, that may be a reason to think about having the tonsils out. The other thing that comes up with the tonsil size and tonsillectomy, it's being done now more for sleep apnea, which is an issue, obstructive sleep apnea. That's an issue for adults, but also for children. And that gets at what Alan was talking about earlier when we were having some discussion on the attention deficit disorder, that sleep, inadequate sleep can lead to children's trouble with attention during the day. So that's something that people are looking at more with tonsil size, and that's another indication for considering having the tonsils out.
One wonders whether the ice cream consumption went down since tonsillectomies became, because the one thing I remember about mine was getting a lot of ice cream afterwards.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a difficult recovery process, actually, compared to some other surgeries. So that's part
it
of
hurt.
The reason. Yeah, and it's a sore mouth for a while, and you have trouble eating. So that's another thing they took into consideration when they were deciding whether to take the tonsils out or not.
And whether to give you ice cream. Thank you,
question,
Joe.
Question, please.
Thanks.
Follow-up question.
Okay, let's go to Dan in Pittsfield. Okay, Dan, you're on.
Hi, I have a follow-up question on the HPV. I've got a teenage son, and at one of his pediatrician visits, they recommended that we get this. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe they said that we needed a series of 3 shots. Is that correct?
That is correct. To have full protection from the HPV vaccine, it's a series of 3 injections spaced over 6 months, ideally.
Okay. So my question is, we got the first one, and then all sorts of things happened in the family, and we never got the other two. And this is about 2 years ago. Do I start over again with the first one, or how do I finish this up properly?
Right. That's a good question. In actuality, Dan, you don't need to start again. The current thinking is that we don't ever really start a vaccine series over again. Studies are done according to certain timing, but the thinking is that they're close to just as effective no matter what the time gap is. So I would go in and get those last 2, and I think you'll still be good.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
And thank you, Dan. Appreciate the call. Okay. So, ladies and gentlemen, there are some free phones now. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We welcome your calls and we want your calls. Let's go to Mark. Okay. Mark, you're on.
Hello, doctor.
Hello, Mark. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, thank you. I have a question about autism. I have a daughter who's a nonverbal woman with autism. How much experience have you had dealing with children who are nonverbal with low developmental processes?
A fair amount, because it's actually a fairly common issue. How old is your daughter now?
Well, ma'am, she's a grown woman now, but she's in her 30s now, but there are I'm involved with the Autism Society, and there are parents with children with autism coming up who have had these problems finding a doctor to deal with their children who cannot verbalize or give any other indications as to what sort of problems that they're having.
I appreciate what you're saying there. You know, it's interesting because in pediatrics in general, we learn to deal with that aspect of being nonverbal from the very beginning, because children, until they're two, really can't communicate all that well with us. But you're right, there are certainly some physicians and pediatricians that are more experienced than others in various developmental topics. We certainly at McAnee Pediatrics have several individuals in our practice with nonverbal autism. That tends to be a more serious and severe form of autism, which is I know has probably been quite a challenge for your family to deal with, but it's important to be able to find a doctor that is knowledgeable and can work with you on that. And some pediatricians have more experience than others, so that's when it comes, it's worthwhile having conversations with practices that you're thinking about joining. Sometimes the organizations, like in our area, being rural, it's somewhat limited, but there's something called the Community Resources for Autism, which has a website and can help people find physicians and other resources for their children.
Well, you know, you raise an interesting question when you say nonverbal for those of us who don't know much about a lot. Nonverbal, does that mean they don't talk, or does that mean what comes out is not communicative?
Means both. They don't talk, and what comes out is not communicative.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Doctor is shaking her head, so she accepts that. Thank you very much, Mark. Appreciate your call.
Thank you very much. Sure
you helped somebody by asking it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Virginia in... No, we won't. We'll take a short break, and then we'll be right back. But Virginia, we're talking just seconds away.
Support comes from New York Oncology Hematology, offering clinical research trials towards FDA approval of anti-cancer drugs. When experience matters most, NewYorkOncology.com for a list of clinical trials. Stewart Chops, we are closer to you, in business since 1921. And Bassett Healthcare Network, bringing heart care to the people of Herkimer, Cobleskill, Cooperstown, Oneonta, and surrounding areas. Bassett.org.
Okay, we're back, and you know, I have to tell you, with Dr. Deborah Buccino, and a board-certified pediatrician with McAnany Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine in Great Barrington. We're very lucky to have her, Harvard-educated, trained in the best traditions. Let's go to Mark in... Nope, we did that already. Let's go to Virginia in Delmar. Virginia in Delmar, you're on.
Hi, I'm wondering about young athletes and their ingestion of muscle milk beyond a good nutritional diet. Muscle milk supplements for the athlete, young athletes.
Doctor, perhaps you can tell me what muscle milk is, because I don't know.
I actually don't know exactly what they're referring to with muscle milk, but I think that Virginia's bringing up the overall point that it's one of the supplements that people use. There's a lot of different supplements mm-hmm. out there, creatine, various different things. And I think the point is that, again, medicine doesn't know everything there is to know. So it's a matter of having the families bring in what they're using and talk about it with the doctor, because the doctor's spent many years in education learning about how the body works, but there's always things to be learned. And in fact, I have to say, at Harvard Medical School, we had a very special education called the New Pathway, where they really taught us by case learning, and they taught us how to look things up. So not a day goes by when I don't go to the World Wide Web and know how to look up information. So if I had a patient coming in asking me about muscle milk, I would actually have to look it up to find out exactly what's in it. And then I would say to the family, well, you know, there's not a lot of, my guess is in muscle milk, there's not a lot of studies out there, so we can't have an evidence evidence-based decision. I think that, you know, sometimes we can say that's okay to use as long as we're comfortable it's not doing harm. I think certain things like creatine, if they're overused, and certainly anabolic steroids and things like that, we know do harm for the athletes, so we have to be a little bit careful about, you know, using things that haven't been validated. But I think if there's a discussion with a doctor, then it can be something that can be useful.
And Virginia, your definition of muscle milk is?
Well, it comes in a carton, and I see many, many young athletes. That's who I'm talking about, not adults, because I know adults do all kinds of supplements. But that's okay. I understand muscle milk is somewhat of an enigma right now to some. So I'll just... carry on with the pediatrician.
Okay. Carry on, Virginia. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
That's great. All right, that leaves one free phone open now. Let's go to Allegra. Hi, Allegra. How you doing?
Hi, good. How are you?
Good.
Hi, doctor. I'm calling as a grandmother. I have a six-month-old granddaughter, and in the early stages of the pregnancy, the mother's pregnancy, there's a test for something called the nuchal translucency. Are you familiar with that?
I am not actually familiar with that. Nuchal translucency.
Nuchal, yeah. In fact, it wasn't something that I, you know, in my day was tested for, so it was a new thing. Okay, well then, maybe...
Can you describe it at all? Because if you can...
Well, apparently it has something to do with the width, the depth of a certain, I don't know whether it's exactly what it is on the back of the neck.
Oh, I think you're thinking about the nuchal fold that they look
nuchal
at.
Fold?
The nuchal fold, the thickness of the neck, sometimes is, if it's excessively thick, it can be one sign of Down syndrome. I'm not sure if that's how this came up for her.
That was one of the possible outcomes that they were, you know, that they were concerned about. And then there were a number of other fairly dire sort of possibilities. And then they also said that after at a certain point they could have testing and that there was a 15% chance that everything would be normal. So in fact, everything did turn out to be normal. They had the baby. The baby is absolutely fine and perfect, and there are no problems at all. But it's a pretty awful period of months of going through that. You know, I guess I was wondering how significant, how definitive that test actually is, because, you know, they'll probably be having another child and maybe we'll be going through the same thing for several months. There's, you know, a very worrisome period.
Right. Well, I think your question brings up the point that as our knowledge base increases, there are a lot of tests that come up, and it's very important for the doctor to be clear about what the statistics are of how likely this test is going to be helpful, how accurate it is, because it's definitely important to think about what the families go through when they have a test result like this. Without knowing the exact test, it's hard for me to speak specifically to that. There are some tests in utero that can be done that are more specific for Down syndrome and things like that. Our knowledge is still advancing.
Okay.
Okay.
Allegra,
okay,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Thanks
it.
A lot.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we'll go to Maureen in Glens Falls. Maureen, you're on.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I have a 16-year-old granddaughter who I'm raising, and she is somewhat of a prodigy. She is an amazing singer, opera, etc. And she will probably have a wonderful career in music. But we have had an increasing problem with sore throats and tonsillitis and strep throat. In fact, she called me just a little while ago to ask me if I could get something for her, because in school today she developed a sore throat and has white spots and so on. So we have talked about having her tonsils out, but I'm wondering if this could possibly change her voice. Is this something we should wait until she's like 18? Or, I know that strep throat can cause other physical anomalies that we don't want to get into, and you know, I just wonder what your opinion is about that.
Well, I'd like to say that you're thinking about all the right things. I mean, it's really important to think about the different factors. I don't want to, you know, if you're going into surgery, you want to think, what am I going to get out of this surgery versus what are the potential downsides to it? Like you mentioned, possibly changing the voice. I'm not aware of anything like that happening, but I would check with your pediatrician and ask for an ear, nose, and throat doctor that perhaps has taken care of a lot of singers or may know that, because I think that's an important question to ask. We'll go back to one simple thing, which is wash hands, wash hands, wash hands, which I just want to reiterate is really the best we can do for ourselves to avoid germ exposure. So she's probably picking up more germs than maybe she needs to. I will also just put out the information that I think is important, that it actually takes 20 seconds if you're actually washing your hands to be effective about washing your hands. So that's why the hand sanitizers, I encourage people, kids, to have those in their backpacks. I think that's a great thing to have at school just to prevent the germ exposure.
Maureen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay, let's go to Donick in West Shokan. Okay, Donick.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. There's growing concern about the effect of Wi-Fi technology on children, particularly in schools, because these institutions are so saturated now with technology. And many districts now are beginning to have forums about it, and there are even you know, some communities in Europe that have banned this technology from schools. I'd like to know what opinion the doctor has, if any, about this concern.
Well, I think that, again, it's worth thinking about. I think the most important thing is that we're thinking about these things. I believe there was a study that came out of Yale just this week that was showing that there's less effect from environmental things like Wi-Fi in general than we have been afraid there might be as far as cancer and things like that. But, you know, I don't think we really have all the information about the Wi-Fi or magnetic fields or cell phones or any kind of those exposures. So I live my life in moderation because I basically feel like these things can benefit us, but too much can be harmful in a lot of different ways, including harmful exposures, but other things too.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, and my concern is the disparity between the studies and the actions that are taken, performed and taken in Europe and what's done here. I mean, there's such a big difference, you know, what would account for that? And, of course, you know, the thing is, you know, even though parents may try to limit their children's exposure in their homes and so forth, many children become really, you know, unwittingly exposed to this with not much choice. And as you rightfully say, there is very little evidence. But I was just curious about what your opinion was.
Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Let's go to Bill in Gloversville. Bill in Gloversville, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, doctors. I have a question regarding HPV. Is there a test that can detect whether or not you've been exposed to it? And if you have, is there a cure?
There's definitely no cure right now, Bill, which is why the vaccine is so important. There are some tests that are done, particularly in the context of a gynecologic exam for a woman, but there is no widespread test now for exposure to HPV. So that's an area that work could certainly be done, but we don't have that test right now.
Okay, thank you very much, doctor.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Okay, let's go to Dick in Long Meadow. Dick in Long Meadow, you're on.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just responding to a lady who was talking about Muscle Milk. Anybody else who's taking these protein supplements for bodybuilding or weightlifting, just a note, I have a lot of experience with this through other family members. If you do a BUN and creatinine clearance, you're going to find out that Muscle Milk and all these other protein supplements are causing abnormal BUN and creatinine clearance. And when you withdraw this super high protein, all those values come back down to normal. So it's probably a cautious thing to do because We don't know what the long-term damage is to the kidney based on these protein supplements.
Thanks for the warning. Appreciate it. Sounds reasonable to me. Okay, let's go to Larry. All right, Larry, your turn.
Thank you very much. An HPV question. Mm. I was diagnosed and treated with throat cancer, and it was linked to the HPV virus. I'm wondering, I am at the age of 65, but I'm a kid at heart, so it's okay to talk to a pediatrician.
Yep, we're glad you called.
Wondering, is there any benefit to having this vaccination?
That brings up an interesting question, Larry. It is probably beneficial for older individuals to get HPV. Right now, the studies have only been done in 25-year-olds and younger, so that is currently what the insurance is paying for. But if you talk to your doctor, there sometimes are instances where it can be helpful. But in your case, unless you had new partners from whom you would get HPV, your body's already developed antibodies to the HPV strains that you were exposed to, so you wouldn't have further benefit. But if you're having more exposure, then it could definitely be worth considering.
I just want to get something straight, but I want to be careful about how I ask this. If you get HPV in the throat, this is because of oral sex? Is that what happens?
Most likely.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, is that a question for my oncologist or my primary?
No, that was a question for our doctor.
Well, I mean,
No, my question as far as pursuing getting a vaccine.
I see. You, probably your primary care doctor, but the issue is that even a lot of the gynecologists now aren't really giving it to older women because the insurance isn't covering it. But if you want to pay for it out of pocket, it's fairly expensive, or petition your insurance, it's possible that your primary care doctor could do that.
Okay, Larry, got to let you go. Thank you very much. Okay, and then the last call will be with Colin from Northampton. Okay, Colin, you're on.
Hello, thank you. I will make it quick.
No, you're okay. Go ahead.
Two-part quick question. I had two of my three children were premature, both at approximately 30 weeks. And I'm in the medical field, and when my first one was born, about 6 years ago, the short of the long is I found out that with premature babies, they give four hepatitis B vaccinations. They get one within 2 weeks of birth, and then they go through the normal routine of three shots like a normal child would. That's my first question is, why do they do that? Because I was curious, if the child was in a neonatal intensive care unit, I wouldn't think you would need that protection.
Okay, Colin, we're getting close to the end of the show, so question two.
And my last quick question is, I noticed that the vaccination they were giving, when I read the bottle, it said it was for 8 to 10 pound babies. It was a standard baby vaccination as opposed to a 4 or 5 pound. And I didn't know if the doctor could quickly talk about that.
Sure. Colin, the hepatitis B vaccine is usually given to kids that are 5 pounds and up. It's hard to speak to specifics. I don't think it's a standard practice to give that first vaccine to a premature baby in the first 2 weeks unless they were concerned about some particular risk to get that extra protection in.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Colin. Well, that's it for today. We are out of time. My apologies to no one because nobody was left on the line. I want to thank Dr. Deborah Buccino for joining us today. Our thanks to engineer Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our producers, Jessica Blaustein Marshall, and I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at WAMC.org/Vox Pop. Remember that the lockbox is there. We're making tremendous progress. We want to get over that halfway mark, and we're getting closer and closer every day. If you value this program, go on to WAMC.org and, throw something into the lockbox. We'll love you for it, and we really appreciate it. It's the only way to keep this thing going. And now, stay tuned now for a little bit of theme music, and then for some news, and then for something else.